This interview is with William H. Highfill, Hank, at his residence at 4334 Kirkwood Drive Southwest on November 19th, 2007. And I am Brian Clark, the interviewer. All right, Hank. Again, thank you for agreeing to this today. But I guess I know that you've lived in this area for most of your life now. So where and when were you born?
I was born at the old Jefferson Hospital in downtown Roanoke on May 9, 1947.
And what neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in Bel Air Circle, which is Southwest County. It was Southwest County of Roanoke. Now it's in the city of Roanoke, mm-hmm. off of Lee Highway, across from, used to be in Arlen's there. Now there's a steakhouse and a McDonald's. Near Lewis, across Keiki Road from Lewis Gale Hospital. Lewis Gale Hospital was a cornfield when I grew up, but that's where I grew up, in that neighborhood.
How long did you live there?
I lived there from birth until I graduated from college and went in the military. So 21, 22 years.
Okay. Did you live there when it was annexed by the city?
No, it was annexed by the city after I left and went in the military. But it's been part of Roanoke probably since some point in the 70s.
Talk to me just a little bit about your family, parents, siblings.
My mom was one of 11 children born to Dr. and Mrs. G.M. Maxwell. My grandfather was an MD and an eye, ear, nose, and throat specialist practicing out of the old medical arts building in downtown Roanoke. It's now the professional arts building next to the Appalachian Power Company. She was one of 11 children. My dad was born.
What was your mom's name?
Caroline Maxwell was her middle name, Heifel. She was, as I said, one of 11 of the Maxwell children who all were born and raised there in Bel Air Circle. My dad was born and raised in the city of Roanoke. His dad worked for the old Railroad Express Agency in Roanoke, and he grew up in Old Southeast, and then his parents moved to the southwest part of the city. And both my parents went to high school, and my mother went to the old Salem High School, which became Andrew Lewis. My dad went to Jefferson High School. They both went to Roanoke College, where they met. They were married and took up residence in Roanoke, raised 8 children there. And my mom died 10 years ago. My dad still lives in the home on Bel Air Circle.
And what was your dad's name? What is your
William
dad's
H. Highfill Jr.
Junior.
I'm the third.
I didn't catch
junior.
The third when I announced that. You're right.
Yes, I'm the first son. I'm the first son of 8 children. I have 2 older sisters.
So it was all 8 of you plus your parents living in
that house. And my grandparents lived next door. They gave my parents land when they married, and my parents built a home next to my grandparents' home. So I grew up with my grandparents and 2 maiden aunts living next door, and then my family of 8 children and my mom and dad. So we had a large family right there in Bel Air Circle. It was a great place to grow up.
I bet. Now, you mentioned that you lived, or where Lewis Gale was a cornfield. Did you guys have a family garden?
We had, my dad had a garden, but he and his brother, my Uncle Gordon, who grew up in Roanoke also, at one point tried to raise pheasants there in the backyard. It was rural at that point, you gotta remember. And my dad and my uncle, when I was probably in grade school, had a huge pen down in the backyard, and they raised pheasants and sold them to the Hotel Roanoke, and they served pheasant for a number of years, and they gave it up because it was too much trouble. It's hard to raise 8 children and not spook the pheasants. We used to spook them regularly. So no, it was my dad worked for the federal government.
What did he do?
He worked for the what is now the Department of Veterans Affairs. It was then the old VA, Veterans Administration, and he worked there for just about 40 years, worked his way up from a clerk all the way to the manager, the top position in the regional office for the last 10 or 12 years of his career. So he was a federal employee and retired as such, as I did.
Now, where did you work?
I started out while I was at Roanoke College working for the post office as a 20-hour-a-week part-time college student. From there, I went into the United States Air Force, where I flew heavy jets for almost 6 years. I was a pilot. I left there and went with the Department of Labor, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration in Roanoke. And then I went with the VA, but I couldn't work in Roanoke because my dad was there, so I worked in Winston-Salem, North Carolina for 3 years, and when my dad retired, I was able to transfer back to Roanoke, and I worked the last 22 years of my career at the regional office in downtown as a administrative officer. I ran all of the in-house administrative functions for the VA.
Now, did your mom work as well? Or did
my mom raised 8 kids, and then when we all reached school age and started going to college, she went to work as a teacher. And she worked as a teacher in special ed, special need kid, during the whole time that she and my dad were putting 8 of us through college. Then she retired. So she had 2 careers. She raised 8 children, then she went to work as a teacher, and then she retired.
Definitely. What kind of activities did you participate in as a child growing up?
We had 8 children in the house, and we had a huge extended family because my grandparents had 11 children. So we had cousins, so we never lacked for playmates, and it was a rural area. Like I said, Lewis Gale didn't exist. It was a cornfield. We just played, we just played in that neighborhood, invented our own games, and had a ball. But it was a terrific way to grow up. But it wasn't anything like it. Like, we would walk to, you know where the River Jack is, 419 and Lee Highway? That's about 2 or 3 miles from our home, and we would walk to there and buy a drink and then get in an inner tube in the Roanoke River and float home. I mean, it was that, you know, and it was, our parents didn't worry about us because it was just a different world, and we just ran loose and had a ball. It really was a terrific way to grow up.
Now, when did you start going to school, and where did you?
My education took place in a 5-block area in downtown Salem. I went to the old Academy Street Elementary School for 1 through 3. I moved a block over to Broad Street Elementary School, which is the original Salem High School, mm-hmm. before Andrew Lewis was built, for grades 4, 5, and 6. Then I moved 4 blocks or so down College Avenue to the Andrew Lewis Annex for the 7th grade, across the street to the Andrew Lewis High School for 8 through 12, and 2 blocks up the street to Roanoke College for my college education. So my entire education, grade school through college, took place in an area that you could walk in. And it's really pretty amazing.
That is pretty amazing.
And most of my brothers and sisters did that. 6 of us. 8 of us, we all got college degrees, 6 from Roanoke and 2 from King College in Bristol.
So what was school growing up like for you at elementary?
It was a totally different world than it is today. Know how to describe it, except that it was very comfortable, more laid back than it is now. The teachers, I got a good education, but there was a great deal more discipline than there is today. There weren't nearly the distractions and the problems that kids face today. It was a very easy time to grow up. We didn't have, I mean, there wasn't any such thing as a cell phone or an iPod or I didn't even know what marijuana was until I was almost a senior in high school. It was just a much more laid back, easy going, and the discipline was much more strict, if that's what you'd want to call it, but it was a no ma'am, yes sir type education. You did what you were told or you got popped in those days.
And did you ever have occasion to get popped?
Never. Although, I had a sixth grade teacher who didn't like me. She gave me a pop one day when I was in the sixth grade. Because we were at the Roanoke, we were at the Annex, and the Annex was across the street, 4th Street from Andrew Lewis, and she's teaching health class, and a truck, big old 18-wheeler, pulled up to the stoplight, and I was conversing with the driver. And I got, but no, I was not a bad kid. But it was really a good, basic education with a lot of what I would call pretty strong discipline.
Now, did you go on to any school after Roanoke College?
I graduated from Roanoke in June of 1969, and on July the 3rd of that year, I was sworn into the Air Force. I went to officer candidate school for 12 weeks and became a second lieutenant, and then I went for 1 year of pilot training. And I would say that's the toughest year of education I've had. Yeah, I think it would probably rival in intensity and just plain old-fashioned hard work any upper postgraduate degree. Mm-hmm. It was good, it was hard.
What was your major at Roanoke?
Business administration. I always wanted to fly. My entire life, but I didn't have any interest in mathematics and engineering, and if it hadn't been for the fact that there was a Vietnam War going on and there was a need for pilots, I would have probably never gotten accepted. But I scored very high on the test that they give for pilot training candidates. My physical was perfect, and I got put on the waiting list. They said, you meet all the qualifications, but we don't have a spot for you. But we'll put you on our standby list. And I called my recruiter and said, I'm going to go join the Navy. And he said, wait a minute. And a week later, I was in pilot training. Well, I was in the class to go to officer training school. And I got to fly.
Did you actually do any service in the war?
Yeah, I flew heavy jets, C-141s, four-engine jet transports. And Jamie and I were married after I finished officer training school and before I went to pilot training. So she went to pilot training with me. One of the reasons I made it through, I think, having that stability and someone there with me. But we graduated pilot training, and you're able to select the aircraft you're going to fly based on your rating in the class. And I was able to get the airplane I wanted so I could fly worldwide airlift. And then we were stationed at Dover, Delaware, and we flew support missions in and out of Vietnam and Thailand. I was never stationed there. I would fly materials in, load whatever they had coming out, which in a lot of cases involved hospital ship flights. We'd bring back wounded and fly them back out. So I flew in support of the war. I didn't actually participate in the war. It was good. Good experience.
I bet.
I used to go into Utapal, Thailand, and Saigon, the big base at Tonsonut, you've probably heard of it. We'd go into there and go in just before light. So we'd get on the ground, it would still be dark. They'd load us and we'd take off just at sunrise to get out of there before things got hectic, if they were going to get hectic. I had a great, great experience.
And though you were in support, you were still there. Missions. What was your interest in flying?
I had two uncles that flew. I had an uncle who flew off of a destroyer. Mm-hmm. He was catapulted off a destroyer, and then he would land. He had a seaplane. He would land on the water, and they'd hoist him back up on. And then I had another uncle who flew off of carriers, but he died in a training mission just before the war started. And then on my dad's side, my uncle Gordon flew military transport during the war. And I always just had a love for airplanes. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to fly one.
And then you did.
And I did. Once I got over being airsick. It was awful. It was awful. But I was terribly airsick for the first 6 months, but once I got over it, it was wonderful.
Well, bringing it back towards Roanoke,
yeah.
If I say Bel Air, Roanoke, when you were childhood, what's the first memory or two that comes to mind? Really sticks
out. We lived up on that hill above, and the VA hospital was across the way, and we could sit up on the hill and watch the trains, the old locomotives, the steam-driven locomotives going in and out of Roanoke, and they still had the Powhatan and the Pocahontas, which were passenger. They were two of the last passenger trains that ran in and out of Roanoke. And I can remember from being very young, sitting up on my grandparents' front yard, you could look down and watch those steam locomotives come in and out of. That's one of my earliest memories. Mm-hmm. The Lehigh Drive-In Theater was just across the river. And we could sit up there and like to watch movies.
Right from your house?
from my grandparents' front yard. I mean, it was just a terrific place to grow up, really was. I was lucky. But that's some of my earliest memories. And just being able to, my mother never, we got up in the morning, she'd fix us breakfast, and before I started school and all, we just ran loose all day long. It was, and we really didn't get any, there wasn't much, any real trouble to get into. Mm-hmm. And we just played in the neighborhood. That's how I grew up.
And did you all have, as your family or yourself, was there a focal point, like a radio or TV or anything
like
that?
We got a TV. I always remember when we got a TV because I was relatively young. It was probably in the mid-50s. And we got an old black and white console television. And my dad set it up with the antenna on the roof and all, and the first program I ever watched was Walt Disney's whatever that show they had, Disney World. Wasn't Disney World at the time. The Wonderful World, it might have been called I think it was just called Disneyland. And then Davy Crockett, Paladin, you don't remember any of these, too young, Gunsmoke. They were, we all hated Sundays because that was the Sunday night was, but on Sunday night, Liberace came on it at like 6 o'clock, and then at 6:30 or 7 was the Wonderful World, what it became the Wonderful World of Disney, it was Disneyland, and then there was the Ponderosa, and Half Gun Will Travel and Gunsmoke. I grew up every Sunday night watching those shows and dreading going to bed and going to school the next day. Yeah, with eight kids, we never got to. Our vacation one year, and our family vacation one year when my dad was still working his way up through the organization, and they were just struggling to make ends meet, was we went to the S&W cafeteria down in Roanoke with 8 kids, and then we went to the Old American Theater and saw How the West Was Won. You could have time, that would have been in the 60s sometime. Mm-hmm. But everything revolved around the family because there wasn't money to, you know, do stuff with 8 children. Mm-hmm. So it was all just family. And every weekend there were cousins on the hill visiting my grandparents. And we just, it was all, my whole growing up experience was just that nuclear family. Mm-hmm. My family and the cousins and my grandparents and my parents.
Did you guys have a porch on your house at all?
We had
acres around you.
Just acreage, but we had a small front porch where we played. Do you ever grow up playing kick the can? It was a kind of a hide and seek game, but there was we'd put a soup can out on the front porch was safe, and whoever was it had to go out. The can would sit out on the sidewalk on front of the porch, and if you'd go out and find somebody, then you had to race back, and if the person who was it could run back and put his foot on the can and say the person's name, they were captured. But if that person could beat you there and kick the can, then they got to run and hide until the person found the can and reset it. We'd play that for hours on that front porch in the front of my house. Mm-hmm. And you'd be racing back, and the person who was it was trying to put his foot on the can, and you were trying to, it's called kick the can. Mm-hmm. We grew up playing that game. You know, there'd be 8 of myself and the siblings, and then 10 or 12 cousins, and you'd have kids all over the neighborhood.
You guys practically had your own school.
And we had our own football games. Mm-hmm. And baseball games. We played softball in the yard for years, and throwback football. Mm-hmm. You don't have teams, so you have one goal line, and you kick the ball. Everybody stands out in the football field. You kick the ball, and whoever catches it tries to run to that one goal line. Everybody else tries to tackle them. And when they're tackled, they have to stop, pick the ball up, and throw it back over their head, whoever catches it. So it's a slow advance down the field until somebody finally scores. Mm-hmm. And we played that for hours. Throwback.
Did you, besides the games and everything, did your family or your siblings have any chores or anything around the house?
My sisters had to work in the house doing the dishes and stuff. And I, being the oldest boy, had to mow the yard. And, you know, things like taking the garbage out and that kind of stuff. But my job, because I was the oldest boy, the only one that allowed to use a mower, I'd spend just hours and hours because we had a huge yard, and I mowed all summer long. The yard was so big, Brian, that if it was really rainy, I could mow the whole yard and just about have to start over. And I mowed I still love to mow.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, but I grew up, that was my job. Yeah, I mowed all summer long. During the winter, no. I mean, there were 8 children, so somebody had to take the trash out, but it wasn't like there were 8 jobs to be.
Right.
But yeah, we got a quarter allowance for it. And that's what I got for doing all the mowing, too. I mean, there wasn't any quarter a week. Mm-hmm. That was pretty good money.
Mm-hmm. Are there any stories that are passed down in your family or things that, or recipes or styles of cooking or things that have come down from your parents?
My mother was really an outstanding cook, but the thing that was most amazing about my mom and the cooking was that there were 8 of us, and every single meal except for breakfast, but every dinner, she would cook 5 pounds of potatoes and serve mashed potato, 5 pounds worth of mashed potatoes or an equal amount of rice at every meal, simply because she had 4 growing boys and 4 girls, and she cooked all the time. So our meals were a big deal because we didn't have a formal dining room. We had a great big kitchen, and the older ones got to sit at the kitchen table with my parents, and the younger ones had to sit at a counter adjoining. And meals were quite a production until we all got old enough to start doing stuff. We all started playing sports and all. And then meals only became a big deal on weekends because it was just, there was so much going on that with 8 of us in school and the boys playing sports and the girls doing this, the only time once we got older that we ever ate together was on weekends because my mother was just feeding kind of a production line type thing. And we'd go over to like I said, my cousins were in every weekend because we had cousins in town, we had cousins in Blacksburg. My uncle was a professor at Virginia Tech. And there was always a huge family meal on Sundays at my grandmother's. And, you know, there could be 30 people there.
Boy, puts a new thought on Thanksgiving, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was a big deal. Wow. But, we kind of grew up around meals because it was such a huge number of people. Mm-hmm. Meals were such a big deal. And when we were younger, the whole family would go camping at Catawba on 4th of July and Labor Day. And that was a humongous deal. There'd be 30 or 40 of us camping on the creek at Catawba. And I mean, those are unbelievable memories. That huge crowd out there. And again, it all, you know, the women spent the whole time cooking and feeding all those people. Mm-hmm. So yeah. When you're that big a family, everything kind of revolves around feeding them all. Mm-hmm. So most of my memories of the group revolve around either sporting events where we all were or meals where we all were. Mm-hmm. And then as we got older and older, there were 4 of us in college at one time, and the other 4 were in grade school and high school. So it would seem like to me sometimes I could go a day or two and not see the whole family. It just became such a big, it was the initial growing up phase, everything revolved around. It was great. It really was.
I bet. Were there any shops or businesses in Bel Air that you guys particularly hung out at?
When we were young, the closest place was Charlie's Market, which I told you was at the River Jack. And we would all find a way to get a dime. And this is just the boys. We'd hike up there and we'd call it going to Charlie's. Mm-hmm. And say, what do you want to do? And we'd all say, let's go to Charlie's. And we'd all scrounge up a dime and we'd hike all the way up to Charlie's and we'd get a soda and a moon pie or something. And then we'd either float back in the river or we'd walk back home. But that was the closest business until the Bel Air Lawn and Garden Center opened, which is down at the intersection of Keggy Road and Lee Highway. It's now a McDonald's, but that's where the Bel Air Lawn and Garden Center was. That was the first business that was, I mean, you could hit it from up on top of the hill, and we did on occasion with a walnut or an apple. We used to stand up on top of the hill. The whole side of the hill was an apple orchard. Mm-hmm. And at night, as young boys, we'd sit up on top of the hill and try to hit cars going down on Keggy Road with an apple. You know, they weren't big apples. They were those little yellow apples. But every once in a while, we'd hit one.
Did they stop?
Yeah, they stopped. But, you know, we were clean up on the hill and we were invisible. Mm-hmm. But that was the only kind of mischief we ever got into, was hitting cars with apples or... But that business opened, and then they built that shopping center across the road. 1 year before that was an airport, by the way. when my mother was young, they lived up on top of that hill above. Bel Air was up on top of the hill above Lee Highway. And across the road was a field where there's now an Appalachian Power substation and a shopping center with some medical offices and a Chinese or Japanese restaurant. That was all an open field, and at one time it was an airport. And on Sundays, the biplanes would fly, and there would be parachute jumping into that field. And my mom watched a guy whose chute didn't open. She's always talked about that. It's one of her vivid childhood memories. Was a guy jumped off of the wing of a biplane and his chute didn't open. But there was an airport down there. Then they built the substation and on Arlen's. You remember Arlen's? Arlen's was a precursor to Kmart and that kind of stuff. It was a kind of a discount department store. When I was in the seventh grade, the circus came to town and set up in that field. That would have been 1959, maybe. So that was the last year that field was a field. And we went down 5 o'clock in the morning and got jobs putting up the big top and working the circus all day for free admission. After that, they built that shopping center there, which would have been 1960, 61. And there have been businesses there ever since. But before that, I was 12 or 13 years old before any type of business other than Charlie's Market, which was 3 miles away. So that's how rural it was. And the only reason we got to go to Salem schools was we were in the county, and Salem was county schools at that point. It wasn't a incorporated city. It was a town. And the kids on either side of us, my grandparents' house faced Lee Highway, up on top of the hill. My dad built next to him facing Lee Highway. Everybody else in the neighborhood who built over the years built facing the other direction, which is basically south. They were all Cave Spring people, but we lived on Lee Highway technically because we faced it. So the kids next door and behind us went to Cave Spring High School. My family went to Andrew Lewis High School because we lived on Lee Highway and they lived on Bel Air Circle.
Was there any contention because of
that? Well, yeah, because we grew up, I mean, when I was growing up, there were like 5 houses in Bel Air. It's now a huge development, but there were like 5 houses, and 4 of those houses had kids growing up who were basically my age. And they all grew up going to the Cave Spring schools, and my family, there might have been 8 or 9 of them, and there were 8 It was a pretty fair fight. But we were good friends as youngsters, but as we grew up, they grew up in Cave Spring type, right? We grew up in Salem. Mm-hmm. So we kind of drifted apart that way. Yeah. I always kind of considered myself more of a Salem person than a Roanoke person because I was educated there.
All the way through?
All the way through.
Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah, it is.
I don't know if there's anything additional to what you've already added, but what types of things were important to you in the area, actual physical area around where you lived?
Until I was high school age, my whole world revolved around my family because that's all there. I mean, it was me and my brothers and my sisters and my cousins. Mm-hmm. We didn't really have outside friends. It was all that. Because it was such a big thing that it was all family. Mm-hmm. We didn't play much with other kids because we didn't need to. There were, if we got involved with other people, it was because they came to us. Mm-hmm. And it took until I was high school age before I started developing friends and all outside of that very tight family type group. So until I was 12, 13 years old, my whole world just revolved around Bel Air Circle and the Maxwell clan, as we were called, because my grandparents were Maxwells. And my mom, of course, was a Maxwell. So I kind of grew up a Maxwell rather than a Heifel. But it took to high school for me to start seeing the world outside of my own family. Because it just... it was such a huge thing. There wasn't any need for, you know, other kids grew up running around with the neighborhood kids. I grew up with my family.
What was it like? You were away for the military, your service in the military in the Air Force, and then you were away in North Carolina. Was it Winston-Salem?
Winston-Salem.
Now, did you experience anything different when you returned to Roanoke after those times away?
Yeah, Roanoke, when I was, Roanoke became a totally different place for me after I grew up as opposed to those formative years. Mm-hmm. Roanoke was my grandfather's medical practice at the Medical Arts Building, and the rare occasion when I went downtown to my dad's office because he worked in downtown Roanoke, and an occasional trip to the S&W cafeteria, which was a big deal in those days, and the Roanoke Christmas parade. That was, I mean, it was, you know, it was a place where we went, but it wasn't really a part of our lives as much as Salem was, mm-hmm. and our family. But after I grew up and came back home, particularly from the military, I mean, that's where I worked. Mm-hmm. Roanoke became more of a focus than Salem really did.
Did you notice any differences in your perspective coming back?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the world changed in the 60s drastically, at least from my perspective. Mm-hmm. I grew up in what I would call kind of an innocent age. I mean, I really didn't think much about anything other than just that little world I was growing up. But the 60s changed everything. Mm-hmm. I think 63, when John F. Kennedy got assassinated, changed me dramatically. And then 68, my whole world kind of changed in 68, because when that year Martin Luther King was killed, Bobby Kennedy was killed, the Vietnam War was an extremely divisive thing, and it was the first election I voted in. The whole world kind of, and I became, and the people I grew up with, those late 60s changed us from the innocent kind of world we grew up in to pretty cynical. I became pretty cynical about things from 63's when it started with that first assassination, but 68 really, I think it was a watermark, at least in my life, in the way I viewed the world. Because those two assassinations and the war and the Richard Nixon, Hubert Humphrey election and subsequent Watergate, I served during the Vietnam War. I saw all that divisiveness. And Roanoke was all part of that. I mean, you know, my view of things, Roanoke was an idyllic place when I grew up. And during the 60s, when I really did grow up, everything, my perspectives on everything changed.
Was it any different at that point, or do you think you just noticed it?
I think the world changed during the 60s. Okay. I really do. I think the way we looked at the world, and I'm just talking about we, the people who I grew up with, mm-hmm. the way we viewed the world in the 50s was drastically different than the way we viewed it by the late 60s, and it wasn't just because we grew up. Mm-hmm. It's because of what we grew up seeing and experiencing. Mm-hmm. The political situation, the assassinations and the Vietnam War, and then serving in it. And I didn't serve in the war, but I was there. I went in, I would go in, fly into Tonsonute, like I said, and just outside Tonsonute was a huge mountain. And there was an outpost on that mountain. And they would put troops up there at night. And we'd land in the morning, and those troops would be coming down. And I would walk into the mess in my nice clean flight suit and my shiny boots and, you know, my captain's bars, and I'd walk in, and those soldiers who had been up on that mountain all night long, you know, with the Viet we'd walk in and they would look at me, and I could, you know, I could tell the way, you know, it wasn't just that I was an officer. I was the guy who was bringing the shit in and taking the shit out, and I didn't have to stay there. It was different. I will remember sitting in those mess tents and eating with those guys, and you know, I could just feel them looking at me like, you know, he's coming in and he gets to leave. And they had, you know, a hollow look in their eyes. But you changed me. Changes it. You changes. And I was taken out. I had one whole airplane full of burn victims. And the airplane smelled like it. And we picked them up in Japan. And they were stacked like cordwood. I didn't think you could have as many guys who were that badly burned. But they would stack the litters up in the cargo hold of the airplane with the nurses all around them. And they'd stack them in there, and we'd take off, and we'd fly 12 hours, 12.3 hours, land in San Francisco. They'd unload them all. We'd go get 8 hours of rest. They'd load those poor sons of bitches, sons of guns back on there. And I'd fly most of them to the burn center at San Antonio. And then a few others would go to Illinois. And I also bought home an entire plane load of drug addicts, kids who had gone over there and gotten hooked on heroin. And they would be so sedated that, you know, that it changes you. So yeah, Roanoke was a different place after, like I said, the mid to late 60s, everything. And Roanoke changed just like everything, but I think a lot of it was my view of the world. But yeah, Roanoke was a different place.
What was your first memory coming back after the war, stepping back into home or Salem or Roanoke?
Well, Jamie and I were at Dover and then Charleston. Dover, Delaware, and Charleston, South Carolina. And then I came back to Roanoke after I got out of the military, and it took 8 months to get a job. So we were on unemployment. I had unemployment benefits built up, and we were on unemployment, and I spent 8 months trying to find a job in Roanoke. And my first memory was there just, I didn't think I was ever going to get one. Then I really got lucky. A guy that worked at the VA was, for my dad, who was the head honcho, so I couldn't work for the VA, was playing poker with a guy who was just been transferred to Roanoke with the Department of Labor, and he was establishing an OSHA office. And he told him he had to hire six or eight new guys and train them to be safety and health specialists. This guy says, "Hey, I know a guy just got out of the," and this, he was a retired Army colonel. He said, "I just know a guy who just got out of the Air Force. He's looking for a job." He said, "Send him to see me." Walked in the door. We hit it off right away because we're both military. He hired me, and that's how I got to stay with the federal government, because I had been an employee of a post office for 2.5 years, 6 years in the military, and then I just got to pick right on up with the Department of Labor, and I put in a total of 35 years. By the time I was 55 years old, I had 35 years in the federal government.
That's incredible.
From age 20 to age 55.
Wow.
And most of it was in Roanoke. The 3 years in Winston-Salem and the 6 years in the Air Force. The rest of it was in the old Carlton Terrace building, I was drafted. I was drafted after my freshman year at Roanoke College, because Roanoke College, bless their hearts, didn't send, you know, you were deferred. They didn't send my grades and my deferment in. I was drafted. And I called the draft board, and they said, "I'm sorry, you've been drafted." And I said, "I'm deferred. I'm a student." They said, so I had to go take my draft physical at the Carlton Terrace building and at downtown Roanoke, which is just up from the hospital, community hospital. And I took my draft physical there, and was processed, and then my deferment came through, so I didn't have to go. I came back from the Air Force, landed a job with the Department of Labor in the Carlton Terrace building, one floor below where I took my where I took my draft physical. That was my first job after that. Was I came back to the place that I had taken my draft physical 8 years earlier. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I worked in downtown Roanoke from that point until I retired.
Wow. And I know that you've done a lot of work in the community, at least with Roanoke College and Habitat.
Since I retired.
What other types of organizations or civic groups or community projects have you been involved in?
I was never, my dad is a big mm-hmm. civic type guy. He belonged to the Kiwanis Club, and he's always trying to get me to join, and I was never a joiner. Mm-hmm. I did, my Jamie and I have always, since we were married, have always had a foster child with Save the Children, and we've always adopted at least one family or more at Christmas and try to make sure they got the same Christmas that we gave our kids. But until I retired, I didn't get a whole lot of involvement in, because I don't know, I'll be honest with you, I was just working and I didn't get very involved.
There's no harm in that.
No, but once, except for that one thing that we've always done, which is great because our girls grew up doing it with us and now they do it. Mm-hmm. And my sister is a social worker with the Roanoke City. Mm-hmm. And she's always given us families that really needed something, so we always felt like we were really doing something good for it. But that was it. I wasn't much of a joiner.
Do you remember growing up in your neighborhood or Roanoke? You had mentioned the parade. Were there other cultural type events that you attended as a child? Doesn't sound like there was much in your neighborhood.
There wasn't much in our neighborhood. The annual Christmas parade was always a big deal. And there was one in Roanoke and one in Salem. And I remember there was I think they called it the American Legion Auditorium. Or maybe the Roanoke. It was the major auditorium, and it burned down. It was a big deal when it burned. But I remember my dad taking us there to see Gene Autry. Hmm. But like I said, my parents had their hands absolutely full raising and educating 8 children, so we didn't do much outside the family until we got older.
Sounds like your family was a cultural.
Yeah, event. we couldn't afford anything else.
Yeah.
So those things that stood out were those things that we did get to do, going to the parades and stuff that didn't cost my mom any money.
Now, you've worked in Roanoke for a good portion
all those years, yeah.
Of your employment.
I like working in downtown Roanoke.
I know there were a few things that impacted the community, like the silk mills when they closed.
My dad worked there.
Oh, no kidding.
The rayon. You're talking about the, was it Selk? What was the name of that? What was the name of that huge plant in downtown Roanoke that made rayon?
I can't remember.
But anyway, that was his first job before he got in with the federal government. I remember when that was really an economic disaster at the time for Roanoke, because it was a huge plant, and it was probably the largest producer of rayon in the country, if not the world. And then rayon lost its favor in the market. Better synthetic materials came along. Rayon was a big deal, and Roanoke had a huge plant. That plant is still... It's in Old Southeast, right on the Roanoke River. And when that plant closed, I remember it didn't affect me, but I remember that it was a really big deal. Impact it had on Roanoke.
Were there other similar types of economic events you remember?
Roanoke was a railroad town. My grandfather was with the Railroad Express Agency. And when my dad grew up and when I was young, everything revolved around the railroad. Mm-hmm. the N&W shops just dominated downtown. That changed, and I remember it happening. It seemed like to me when the GE plant came to Salem, that was a huge thing. But Roanoke changed from a railroad town to a banking town. And I've watched that happen. I mean, there was, as I remember Roanoke growing up, there was basically one bank, and that was the First National Exchange Bank, which was down on Jefferson Street, Franklin, Jefferson Street, and Campbell. That was, you know, and there was a Colonial American across the street, but FNEB, what it became, was it. And I've, you know, Roanoke has just become it's the banking center for this part of the state.
Sure.
And that's what I watched. It changed from a railroad town to what I would consider a banking. It's got to be one of the major. And I don't know that for a fact, but it seems like to me I watched Roanoke change from a railroad town to a banking center, and then the VA hospital and the GE plant.
Huge difference. But any of your friends or neighbors or anybody, not that you had a whole lot of neighbors, but did anybody own their own businesses?
The guy next door was an architect, and he had his office down at the foot of the hill and tried to make a go of it as an architect, and finally had to give it up and went to work for my dad at the VA and the loan guarantee. And the neighbors down the street, the Cook family, ran the Bel Air Lawn and Garden Center, which was a privately owned business. And one of my neighbors ran the Via Hardware store. The other neighbors were professional people, several doctors in the neighborhood, and a guy that sold drugs, not illegal drugs. He sold pharmaceuticals. But I mean, the only people that I grew up around or knew that had their own businesses were the Cooks, who ran Bel Air Lawn and Garden, and Dick Grant, who, I don't know if you call it a business, but he had his architect shop down there on Lee Highway, and then the hardware store. But no, nobody else that I knew that ran their own businesses.
Okay. Well, suppose if you were to maybe take a step back 5 years to today, and you maybe take a step outside of Roanoke, and if somebody came up to you that was maybe from Montreal, London, Atlanta, how would you describe Roanoke to them?
Well, I've always kind of felt like Roanoke and Salem both were a little bit of a closed society. To you were a Roanoker or a Salemite, and that made you part of the in crowd, and then there, if you weren't, you weren't. I've always kind of felt like when I was growing up, and it's still to that way a whole lot in Salem, I think. You're a Salemite or you're not. And I always kind of felt like Roanoke was the same way, but that has changed as I've gotten older. I think the population of Roanoke has changed drastically. When I was growing up, everybody kind of felt like they were Roanokers or Salem people. And now I don't think it's nearly that way. But yeah, I felt like we were a little bit. In the other places I've lived, the societies I thought were more open and receptive than Roanoke and Salem were. If you weren't part of the in crowd, at least my feeling was when I was growing up, you were either one of us or you weren't. Mm-hmm. You were part of the Roanoke-Salem community or you were an outsider. I don't think that's the way it is today, but that's the way it was then.
Now, if you were to imagine back all these long years, and or even today, actually, if you were to imagine a walk, favorite walk or a favorite drive in the Roanoke-Salem area, what might that be as a child or as an adult?
The walk, I spent 20-some years taking a walk around downtown Roanoke every day at lunch. I mean, that's what my boss and I did, is we walked, and I've always kind of enjoyed just walk. You walk from the federal building down Franklin, through Elmwood, the city market, across the bridge over to the Hotel Roanoke. I've always thought that was a terrific place just to walk. As far as Mill Mountain and the Parkway, if I was going to drive, my two favorite drives would be to go up Mill Mountain and look out the valley from Starr, and go up the Parkway to Peaks of Otter, or go over 311 to Catawba, get the old Blacksburg Road, and ride all the way back up through the valley, Ellet Valley and all that, all the way into Blacksburg, and then down 460 back in Roanoke. I think those are terrific drives, particularly in the fall.
Yeah. What are the biggest changes that you have that really stand out in your mind if you were to think of this area as a child to now? And you've mentioned a few, I know, but is there anything else that really stands out?
Well, it's Roanoke, and I shouldn't, has more of a, to me, it has more of a congested big city feel than it did when I was young. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just more people, and Roanoke is landlocked. Mm-hmm. And I, back then, I felt like there was all kinds of room. And it didn't take you any time to get out of civilization and into the country. Mm-hmm. And now I feel like Roanoke is just basically a landlocked community that is growing up the mountains. It's becoming uglier than it was in those days because the mountains were gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And now the mountains are becoming developments. Roanoke is just gotten whole lot bigger, a whole lot more crowded, and it's still a beautiful place, but it's not nearly as pretty as it used to be. Because now, particularly if you're going this way, the
going towards Bent Mountain? Or?
Yeah, Bent Mountain. They're building everywhere because there's no place to go. And if you go, my brother's the football coach at William Byrd, and when we He's been the head football coach there since 1981. And we've been playing in the same stadium every Friday night during the fall. And I go out and we sit on the back row at the top. And the view that you see from the back row to the top of that stadium now compared to 1980, you wouldn't know you were in the same place.
What's different?
It's you now look over the visitor stands back up towards the mountains and you see nothing but houses. Mm-hmm. And you can now see traffic on the parkway. Mm-hmm. And just 30 years ago, it was just mountains. And you couldn't see the parkway. Roanoke, I love Roanoke, but Roanoke is, like I said, it's locked in. There isn't but so much room in Roanoke, and we've now reached a point where it's a bowl, and we're building right up the sides of the bowl to the rim because there's no place else to go. That's my biggest disappointment in Roanoke. That and the fact that 419, I mean, I used to be able to walk that route. That's how we went to Charlie's Market. And now it's a different world, but I wouldn't even think about allowing my kids to do that when they were growing up. My parents didn't think a thing about it.
Have there been any positive changes to this area?
I mean, there's a whole lot more to do. Mm-hmm. It's a great place to live. And I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. I mean, I'm saying a lot of negative things about, but that's just a fact of 2008-7 versus 1947.
Yeah. Big difference.
A totally different world. Roanoke's a great place. There's a whole lot more to do. But it's just a different place. A whole lot more people. Although, you know, if you do the census, I don't guess it. When I first started, I remember when Roanoke broke 100,000. It was a big deal. Well, now they're still struggling to, you know.
Still right there at it.
Yeah, you can't, and they won't ever get, you know, because they've annexed everything they can annex. It's everything else that's getting bigger. Salem was 10,000 people. I remember that. Roanoke was 60, 70, 80,000 people in the whole metropolitan area, and Salem was 10. And it stayed that way for, now it's, you know, Salem's probably 30. Roanoke's 104, 5, 6, whatever. But the counties. You have, you know, I really can't, unless you've been here, when we stood up on that hill, because I grew up on a hill, and you could look all the way over to Fort Lewis Mountain, across the VA hospital and out Salem, and you didn't see anything. Mm-hmm. And now you just see nothing, you know, it's nothing but civilization.
And that's a lot of the reason why we're doing this, is to help preserve some of
it's
that processing.
It's phenomenal. And I'll, you know, we'd sit up there and watch that train go. It was neat, because those were neat old trains, those steam engines. And, you know, you'd wait for traffic to go down Lee Highway. You know, a car would come, and you'd wait a while, and you'd see another car. Now, you can't cross Lee Highway. Uh-oh. Different world.
Yeah.
But I love it. I mean, I'm not knocking. It's just a fact of life. We used to sleigh ride down my grandparents' front driveway all the way down the hill and come out at the bottom of the hill at Keggy Road and Lee Highway. And my sister and several other people on a number of occasions would go right on across the highway.
Oh my gosh.
You know, because they couldn't stop, and I mean, there wasn't any traffic. You just right across Lee Highway and into the field. Mm-hmm. Now, you know.
Wouldn't want to do it now.
But that's just, you know, that's the environment I grew up in, mm-hmm. as opposed to, except for my A&M Hunter, don't you tell us. She would drive us to school because she was a teacher, and we'd get down for the. She got this from my grandfather. She'd stop at that foot of the hill, and if there was traffic, you know, GE had opened, you know, and there was a lot more traffic, and she'd wait what she figured was her lot of town. She said, "Okay, I've waited long enough." And she'd pull me.
Even if something was coming.
And I've heard my grandfather was the same way, so.
Gotta have a little fun.
My turn. And if you interview her, don't you even dare. That's another memory, Brian. I can remember my parents, there were eight of us, mm-hmm. and there were no seatbelts in cars. And I grew up standing mm-hmm. in the front seat between the driver and whoever the passenger, and every time we'd go down the road to the stoplight, whoever was driving, the arm would come out to hold the child who was standing in the middle. And I remember, I'd be standing, and I remember every time we came to a stop, my Aunt Emma Hunter or my mom or dad, whoever it was, would reach over and
swing that right arm out.
Swing that right over. You know, and I grew up and finally realized what an absolute futile attempt to do anything that was. I mean, if you know, but that's, there were 10 of us in that car, my parents and 8 kids, and there wasn't a seatbelt in the thing.
Hmm.
And we were stacked like cordwood, because we had a station wagon, there were 3 people in the front seat, 4 people in the second seat, and that left at least 3, and usually more, who were in the back of the station. Can you imagine what would happen if they had hit a tree?
Oh, man.
And if they had had the requirement for child safety seats that they do now, my parents wouldn't have been able to take us anywhere. Mm-hmm. But we just, they'd stack us back there, we'd take a pillow and drive to Myrtle Beach with 10 people in that station wagon.
That's incredible.
First time I ever saw the beach, this wasn't the station wagon. 10 of us drove to Myrtle Beach in a Ford Fairlane. And I mean, there were kids all over the place. And back then, that was almost a 10-hour drive. Mm-hmm. Mm. Those are memories, buddy.
Oh, I bet they are. It sounds like it. Well, speaking of that, I'm at the end of my questions, Hank. Is there any other things like that that you want to, that I've prompted or anything else come to mind?
Oh, I'll tell you one thing. I rode the last streetcar that ever ran in the city of Roanoke. My grandfather worked for the Railroad Express Company. He called my dad and said, the last streetcar is going to run whenever. And I'm coming out to get, he had a friend who could get him on the last streetcar run. He worked for the city somehow. He said, I'm going to take him on the last run of a streetcar. I was too young to remember it all. I've just been told this. He came out and got me, took me downtown, and my grandfather and I rode the last streetcar that ever ran in Roanoke. Hmm. I don't know what the date was. I don't know anything about it. But if you ever went back and found when the last streetcar ran in Roanoke, I was on the sucker.
Know where you were. That's great.
Yeah, I guess. I don't even know where it ran. I know it ran down Campbell Avenue and up Jefferson Street.
Maybe they'll bring them back. We'll see. Well, Hank, thank you very much.
Hey,
I appreciate your time.
I don't know if it did any good.
Oh, it was great.
It was a hoot.
That was very good. Thank you very much.
You need to talk to him, honey.